Chapter 10, Blame the Victim. Cut power or lose it, scream the headlines. In August 2003, an unprecedented power blackout pulled the plug on 50 million people living in a 9,300-square-mile triangle bounded by New York City in the east, Detroit in the west, and Ottawa in the north. Officials warned of further blackouts if people didn't start conserving energy. After the power returned, a radio journalist in Toronto dubbed the Hydro Vigilante roamed the streets interrogating people she found wasting energy, including a man pushing an electric lawnmower and an old woman sitting in front of her air conditioner. Media stories blasted irresponsible juice hogs. I overheard a bus driver and a passenger agree we could not return to our wasteful ways. People felt justified in scrutinizing their neighbors' habits. After all, didn't our wanton use of power cause the problem, and weren't we responsible for fixing it? The answer is no on both counts. Ever since the U.S. power industry was deregulated in the 1980s, energy experts had warned of the probability of large-scale blackouts. Before deregulation, government controlled the generation and distribution of electricity. After deregulation, no one was accountable for making sure the system worked. Freed from enforceable operating standards and hungry for profit, power companies cut every corner they could. Between 1994 and 1996, there were three major blackouts affecting Western North America. A joint U.S.-Canada investigation into the 2003 blackout found no evidence of excess power use by consumers. The power went out because of managerial incompetence, poorly trained workers, lack of coordination, and numerous violations of operating standards. In short, an electricity grid designed to produce power was being operated to produce profit. Electricity users got no apology for being falsely accused. Ordinary people continue to be blamed and to blame themselves for systemic problems over which they have no control. The reason why goes back to the beginning of capitalism. The myth of scarcity. When France's Queen Marie Antoinette was informed that her people were starving, she replied that if they lacked bread, they should eat cake instead. Her arrogance enraged the people, and they chopped off her head. The lesson was not lost. Rulers who wish to keep their heads cannot openly thumb their noses at those they exploit. Minister Thomas Robert Malthus, 1766 to 1834, was determined to prevent a revolution in England by providing explanations for social problems that protected the capitalist class and its system. To explain poverty and deprivation, he argued that there are too many people and not enough to go around. To explain why wealth could not be shared, he insisted that the poor were biologically inferior and that improving their condition would only cause them to multiply. According to Malthus, natural law, quote-unquote, made it impossible to achieve the ideals of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Malthus believed that what was good for the capitalist class was good for society, and that any threat to the flow of profits threatened society. In The Legacy of Malthus, Alan Chase writes, quote, "To Malthus, any measures that ease the lot of the greatest number of people, from sanitary reform to medical care to birth control, and above all else higher wages, were not only immoral and unpatriotic, but also against the laws of God and nature." According to Malthus, all such social instruments for the improvement of the individual, family, and public health shared the common and fatal tendency to remove a necessary stimulus to industry, close quote. Malthus is known as the founder of scientific racism because he was the first to use scientific-sounding language to legitimize prejudice and bigotry. His 1978 publication, Essay on the Principle of Population as it Affects the Future Improvement of Society, argues that workers are not impoverished by capitalism, but by their inferior biology. In essence, that their poverty is genetic. Chase observes, quote, "With or without Malthus, people of means would still hate to pay the taxes required to fund effective legislation for social welfare. However, by demeaning the intrinsic worth to society of most newborn children and their families, as well as by denigrating the value to the greater society of any and all human welfare legislation, scientific racism and its propagandists have for two centuries served successions of greedy men and penny-pinching governments. Close quote. Malthus laid the basis for modern victim-blaming. He was the first PR man for capitalism, promoting fictions like, "People starve because there are too many of them. They are poor because they are lazy. They are in prison because they make bad choices. They suffer inequality because they are inferior. They destroy the environment because they consume too much. They get sick because they don't take care of themselves. And they are injured because they are accident prone." Before we examine these arguments, let's look at how Malthus' ideas were propagated. The genetic superiority of wealth. Francis Galton, 1822-1911, was a wealthy man who perverted genetics to support class inequality. In Hereditary Genius, Galton declares that intelligence is hereditary because the children of the rich are more likely to rise to the top of society. He ignores the fact that they inherit their family's wealth. Because the rich are healthier, Galton argues, they must be biologically superior. Therefore, society could be improved if those of, quote, superior breeding stock have more children and the poor are prevented from having any. Galton opposed all social programs that might allow more, quote, ineffectives to survive and breed. He coined the term eugenics, meaning well-born, to describe his efforts to improve humanity through selective breeding. Herbert Spencer, 1820-1903, also corrupted science to justify class inequality. He created social Darwinism, a fraudulent science that applies, quote, natural laws to human society. It was not Darwin, but Spencer, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Spencer insisted that the poor are biologically unfit to live and that supporting them only burdens the wealthy with taxes. On this basis, he campaigned against state-funded education and medical care, opposed all laws to improve working conditions, and rejected all forms of charity, including food for the starving. Galton, Spencer, and other followers of Malthus, Malthusians, rejected all scientific evidence that improved social conditions improved people's health. Cholera epidemics had plagued England since 1831. By 1866, a network of clean water and sewage systems ended these epidemics. In Liverpool, basic sanitation measures had dramatically reduced deaths due to smallpox, measles, scarlet fever, and typhoid fever. Nevertheless, Malthusians continued to insist that poverty and inequality are rooted in biology and cannot be altered because they did not want to raise workers' expectations that they had a right to a better life. Like all charlatans, they understood that a well-crafted lie, vigorously defended by influential people, can triumph over the truth. This strategy continues to serve the capitalist class. A 1969 memo from the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company observed, quote, "Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also a means of establishing a controversy." Close quote. A 1998 memo from the American Petroleum Institute outlined its strategy to promote doubt about global warming. Quote, "Victory will be achieved when recognition of uncertainty becomes part of the conventional wisdom." Close quote. A strategy of sowing doubt keeps genuine scientists on the defensive, trying to prove the merits of their findings. In fact, these battles have nothing to do with truth or science. They are about protecting the right of the rich and powerful to run society in their own interests. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Eugenics in America. Malthus' theories found a home in 19th century America, where the class struggle was raging. To bolster their side, the capitalist class embraced the theory that the rich are superior beings with a natural right to rule society. In 1910, the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Harriman families funded Charles Davenport, a professor of biology at Harvard University, to document the hereditary basis of poverty and inequality. At the turn of the century, poor people in the American South were suffering an epidemic of pellagra, a disease that causes skin rashes, muscular weakness, dizziness, and mental deterioration. Davenport was a devout Malthusian who argued that pellagra and other diseases of the working population were hereditary. Appointed head of the Pellagra Commission, Davenport promoted a do-nothing policy on the basis that treating pellagrins would only allow them to survive to breed more pellagrins. In 1916, Dr. Joseph Goldberger, head of the Public Health Service, showed that pellagra was a form of malnutrition that could be cured by eating foods rich in vitamin B6. Davenport rallied influential doctors and politicians to reject Goldberger's findings, with the result that pellagra was ignored for another 17 years. Davenport's mission was to reduce the numbers of poor and rebellious people in society. Allowing them to die from disease was one strategy. Eugenics was another. Davenport's Eugenics Records Office was instrumental in shaping two arms of American eugenics policy: forced sterilization and racist immigration controls. In 1907, the state of Indiana passed the world's first compulsory sterilization law in the belief that, quote, heredity plays a most important part in the transmission of crime, idiocy, and imbecility. In 1913, President Theodore Roosevelt declared, quote, it is obvious that if in the future racial qualities are to be improved, the improving must be wrought mainly by favoring the fecundity of the worthy types. At present, we do just the reverse. There is no check to the fecundity of those who are subnormal. Close quote. In 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of forced sterilization, declaring, quote, it is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from breeding their kind. Close quote. By 1931, 30 states had passed laws to sterilize members of the, quote, socially inadequate classes. Compulsory sterilization was promoted for the, quote, feeble-minded, anyone thought to be insane, criminal, or delinquent, epileptics, alcoholics, and drug addicts, the deaf, blind, and crippled, anyone with tuberculosis, syphilis, leprosy, or any other chronic infection, and dependents upon the state, including inmates of government institutions, paupers, orphans, and the unemployed. People could be designated as feeble-minded and sterilized simply for doing poorly on IQ tests. Recent immigrants, those who knew little English, and the poorly educated, fell into this category. In the midst of the Great Depression, the Third International Congress of Eugenics convened in New York City. The Congress called for the mass sterilization of unemployed workers and their children to eliminate, quote, the existence among us of a definite race of chronic paupers, a race parasitic upon the community, breeding in and through successive generations, close quote. One speaker declared that, quote, a major portion of this vast army of unemployed are social inadequates, and in many cases mental defectives, who might have been spared the misery they are now facing if they had never been born, close quote. By 1935, an estimated 20,000 people in the U.S. had been forcibly sterilized. In theory and practice, the United States had become the world's foremost advocate of racial purity. Germany's 1993 Nazi Act for averting descendants afflicted with hereditary diseases was openly modeled on Davenport's 1922 model sterilization law. Between 1933 and 1945, Nazi Germany sterilized an estimated 2 million people and exterminated millions more in race hygiene death camps. Instead of being horrified, American eugenicists praised Germany's bold pursuit of racial improvement. In 1934, the editor of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine proclaimed, quote, Germany is perhaps the most progressive nation in restricting fecundity among the unfit, close quote. Psychiatrists were especially enthusiastic. In 1931, the president of the American Psychiatric Association advised, quote, "I believe the time has arrived when we should, as an association, again most strongly express our approval of the procedure of sterilization as an effective effort to reduce the number of the defective population." Close quote. Between the 1930s and the 1950s, the American Journal of Psychiatry published numerous articles in support of eugenic sterilization and euthanasia. A 1942 article recommended euthanasia for severely mentally disabled children who should, quote, "never have been born, nature's mistakes," close quote. An editorial in the same issue advised psychiatrists to convince parents of such children that euthanasia is the most humane solution. Both American and German eugenics policies were based on the belief that some races are superior to others, and that social problems can be solved by preventing the most disadvantaged people from having children. Historian Howard Zinn points out that the U.S. did not enter World War II to fight Hitler's ideas of white Nordic supremacy. On the contrary, quote, "the United States Armed Forces were segregated by race. When troops were jammed into the Queen Mary in early 1945 to go to combat duty in the European theater, the blacks were stowed down in the depths of the ship near the engine room, as far as possible from the fresh air of the deck, in a bizarre reminder of the slave voyages of old." Close quote. After the war, when the full horror of the Nazi genocide came to light, talk of racial purity was discredited in the U.S. Facing a public relations crisis, the American eugenics movement reinvented itself as a campaign against overpopulation. The poor would still be blamed for social problems, not for being genetically defective, but for being morally deficient, lazy, criminal, and most importantly, too numerous. Culling the poor. After World War II, America's campaign to sterilize the poor escalated, bolstered by a new generation of Malthusians like William Vogt. Published in 1948, Vogt's book, The Road to Survival, warns that the greatest threat facing humanity is too many poor people. According to Vogt, the United Nations should not ship food to keep alive 10 million Indians and Chinese this year, so that 50 million may die 5 years hence. Special venom was reserved for advocates of the poor who, quote, "through medical care and improved sanitation, are responsible for more millions living more years in increasing misery," close quote. Alan Chase points out how influential these arguments were. Quote, "Every argument, every concept, every recommendation made in the Road to Survival would become integral to the conventional wisdom of the post-Hiroshima generation of educated Americans, would for decades come to be repeated, restated, and incorporated again and again into streams of books, articles, television commentaries, speeches, propaganda tracts, posters, and even lapel buttons." In the 1950s, the U.S. began testing, quote, "population control measures on poor people in Puerto Rico." By the end of the 1960s, more than one-third of women of childbearing age on the island had been sterilized. By 1980, Puerto Rico had the highest rate of female sterilization in the world. Population control methods developed in Puerto Rico were exported for use in other poor nations. The social movements of the 1960s opposed mass sterilization programs, arguing that high rates of poverty were caused by economic exploitation, not overpopulation. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb to counter these arguments. Like Vogt, Ehrlich insisted that overpopulation, not poverty, is the greatest threat facing humanity, and he opposed giving food aid to famine-stricken nations unless they agreed to sterilize their poor. The Population Bomb became a bestseller. By the late 1960s, America was pouring millions of dollars into foreign and domestic sterilization programs. In the United States, poor people, First Nations peoples, and black people were targeted. Poor black women were sterilized so frequently that the procedure was named the Mississippi appendectomy. In 1974, federal judge Gerhard Gesell ruled that, quote, Poor people have been improperly coerced into accepting a sterilization operation under the threat that various federally supported welfare benefits would be withdrawn unless they submitted to irreversible sterilization, close quote. According to the judge, quote, over the last few years, an estimated 100,000 to 150,000 low-income persons have been sterilized annually under federal-funded programs, close quote. Despite such condemnation, forced sterilization continued. In the 1990s, Medicaid paid for poor women to have hormone-releasing contraceptive devices planted under their skin. Removing the device was not funded. In 2000, a Louisiana woman convicted of child abuse was given the, quote, choice of medical sterilization or lengthy jail time. Too many people? Today, sections of the environmental movement continue to promote the false doctrine of overpopulation. The website of Support a Comprehensive Sierra Club Population Policy, SUSPS, states, unending population growth and increasing levels of consumption together are the root causes of the vast majority of our environmental problems. This is a dangerous argument. If you believe that too many people are destroying the planet, then you would have to cheer every famine, war, flood, and earthquake that reduced the population. You would also have to welcome diseases that kill millions every year. Contrary to popular belief, environmental destruction is not caused by too many people on the planet. Environmental damage is accelerating despite falling global birth rates. Between 1970 and 2000, the fertility rate in the world's poor nations dropped more than half, from 6.2 down to 3. In Europe, the fertility rate has fallen to 1.4, which is below replacement level. The United States has the greatest impact on the environment, yet its fertility rate has been below the replacement level for the past 3 decades. There are several reasons for declining fertility. More people are moving from rural to urban centers. Rural families benefit from more children helping on the farm. Rural families benefit from more children helping on the farm, while urban families can achieve higher living standards by having fewer children. Also, women who gain access to education and jobs have fewer children. Poverty is not caused by people having too many children. People have more children when they are poor. Malthus was also wrong about hunger being the result of too many people and not enough food. There is only one reason people go hungry. There is only one reason people go hungry. Food is produced for profit, not for need. We can produce enough to feed twice the number of people living on the planet, but if all that food came to market, the price of food would plummet. To keep prices high, states restrict food production or keep what is produced off the market. To keep farmers on the land, they are paid not to produce. The ridiculous result is that some people pay inflated food prices and higher taxes for farm subsidies, while others cannot afford to eat at all. In India, where more than half the children are malnourished, the state spends more to stockpile food than it does to feed the hungry. People are not the problem. Environmental destruction is caused by social policies that put profit first. It is profitable to pillage natural resources and to use the environment as a dumping ground. The belief that social and environmental problems are caused by too many people persists, not because it is true, but because it serves the ruling class. Part 4 explains how production could be reorganized to meet the needs of people and the environment. The twin myths of scarcity and overpopulation provide the false explanations for class inequality. The more the majority can be convinced to tighten their belts, the more the elite can stuff under theirs. Malthusian lies make the unacceptable seem inevitable. Beggars on the streets of the world's most prosperous cities, millions starving while mountains of food are left to rot, people dying because medicines are priced out of reach, one part of the population being overworked, while the other part is desperate for work. Obscene wealth growing alongside desperate poverty. Class struggle. The war between the classes is conducted in 2 dimensions. In the material realm, the capitalist class extracts surplus from a working class that resists exploitation. In the realm of ideas, the doctrines of the capitalist class do battle with opposing ideas. For capitalism to survive, the capitalist class must dominate both dimensions. Opposition to the ruling class and its ideas ebbs and flows, depending on the relative strength of the opposing classes. During the 1950s, the ruling class was more confident and smashed the opposition and its ideas. During the 1960s, the working class pushed back, challenging the ruling class and its ideas. Over the past few decades, the ruling class has taken back the ground it lost during the 1960s and strengthened ideas that blame the victim. To win the next round, we need to understand how we lost the last one. After World War II, Black American veterans believed they had earned the right to equality at home. Over the next two decades, their struggle for civil rights merged with other struggles to form a general working class rebellion. During the 1960s, millions of Americans demanded racial equality, women's liberation, aboriginal rights, gay liberation, safer conditions at work, more affordable housing, better schools, and more access to medical care. There was an organized opposition to poverty, pollution, nuclear power, the arms race, the death penalty, and U.S. foreign policy. A massive anti-war movement challenged U.S. imperialism, and American cities were shaken by Black rebellions. The belief that ordinary people could change the world was in the air, and it was intoxicating. Support for capitalism was cracking in the heart of the system. The ruling class fought back on two fronts, granting limited reforms to promote confidence in the system and moving to crush the opposition. Let's look at the reforms first. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson announced a war on poverty and launched social programs like Head Start, food stamps, Medicare, and Medicaid. Passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act made it easier for Black people to vote. The Civil Rights Act made racial discrimination illegal. To counter past discrimination, affirmative action policies set aside some jobs, admission to higher education, and other opportunities for members of oppressed groups. In 1967, a moratorium was placed on executions. That same year, the Supreme Court ruled that children had the right to due process. In 1973, women won the legal right to abortion. In 1970, Congress enacted the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, to improve workplace health and safety. All over the country, employers raised wages and benefits. These social improvements were no act of charity. They were won by masses of people who fought and died for them. The ruling class also met the call for social justice with repression. Civil rights demonstrators were attacked with water hoses, dogs, clubs, and guns. Black churches were bombed, and civil rights workers were murdered. Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965, and Martin Luther King was killed 3 years later. Between 1967 and 1968, dozens of leading members of the Black Panther Party were imprisoned and murdered. Chicago police viciously attacked demonstrators during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Deadly force was used to suppress anti-war campus protests. In 1970, the National Guard killed 4 students at Kent State University and wounded 9 others. At Jackson State University, police killed 2 students and wounded 12 others. Despite reforms and repression, the social crisis deepened. The U.S. was losing the war in Vietnam. The North Vietnamese forces refused to be beaten, and the American people had turned against the war, and the U.S. Army was in revolt. The Watergate scandal exposed the corruption at the heart of the system. In 1973, the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam. In 1974, President Nixon resigned in disgrace. That same year, the economy went into recession. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The Employers' Offensive. Battered by social protest, imperial defeat, and economic crisis, the capitalist class was desperate to restore its credibility and its profitability. In 1972, the heads of major U.S. corporations organized a business roundtable to, quote, enable chief executives from different corporations to work together, close quote, to influence public policy. Founders of the business roundtable included the chief executives of Alcoa, General Electric, and U.S. Steel. In 1974, Business Week described the difficulty of their task, quote, it will be a hard pill for many Americans to swallow. The idea of doing with less so business can have more. Nothing that this nation or any other nation has done in modern economic history compares in difficulty with the selling job that must be done to make people accept the new reality, close quote. And sell they did. Through newspapers, magazines, radio and television stations, book publishers and movie studios, the new reality was called neoliberalism or trickle-down economics. The plan was for workers to accept less in the present in order to build the economy, which would then reward them with higher living standards in the future. This was not a new idea. In 1961, President Kennedy had claimed that a rising tide would raise all boats. It was pure PR, designed to get the majority to back the goals of the ruling class. It was also a lie. Under capitalism, wealth produced at the bottom flows up. It never trickles down. As one chorus, the ruling class touted economic growth as the best way, the only way, to solve social problems. However, neoliberalism was never about solving social problems. It was the beginning of a one-sided class war to restore the power and profitability of American capitalism. This war had two fronts: to restructure the economy in favor of the capitalist class, and to undercut resistance by blaming the victim. The more that ordinary people blame themselves and each other for social problems, the less they would challenge the system. By the late 1970s, the employers' offensive was in full swing. To restructure the economy, governments gave massive tax cuts to corporate America and removed many of the restrictions on business that had protected workers and the environment. Deregulation and, quote, downsizing spelled the end of hundreds of thousands of good jobs. Employers demanded concession contracts to roll back wages and benefits they had previously granted. Union-busting companies proliferated. In 1980 alone, the National Labor Relations Board reinstated 10,000 workers who had been illegally fired for union organizing. The massive upward transfer of wealth caused the 1980s to be known as the looting decade, which was followed by the even greater plunder of the 1990s. Between 1981 and 2000, the average annual compensation of the 10 highest-paid executives in the United States soared from just under $4 million to $154 million. A rising economic tide was lifting the yachts by sinking the rowboats. Never before had real wages fallen while the economy was booming. Life for ordinary people became harder and meaner. Someone had to take the blame for falling living standards, and it was not going to be the capitalist class. Assault on the poor. The second front of the employer's offensive was to blame the victim. Blaming the victim shifts criticism away from unjust social policies and onto the victims of those policies. Victim blaming also makes it easier to transfer tax revenue from social programs into the pockets of the rich. During the 1960s, right-wing groups and individuals pumped out blame the victim propaganda. However, pressure from social movements kept these ideas on the fringe of society. The employer's offensive brought them back into the mainstream. When Charles Murray wrote Losing Ground to attack social welfare programs, the ruling class embraced it as gospel. President Ronald Reagan concocted the outrageous myth that women on welfare were living high off the hog, wearing fur coats and driving Cadillac cars. As the media jumped on the poor-bashing bandwagon, the image of the welfare queen became a symbol of the undeserving poor. In 1994, The bell curve, intelligence and class structure in American life, became a bestseller. Reviving Malthus equations, authors Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein claim that the growing gap between classes is caused by smarter people rising to the top of society, marrying each other, and having even smarter children, while duller people fall to the bottom of society, marry each other, and have even duller children. The authors conclude that social resources should be shifted away from those at the bottom of society, who will always be dull and poor, to the better off, who have better prospects of fulfilling their potential. The bell curve contained hundreds of pages of scientific-looking charts and graphs, all bogus. Like Losing Ground, the bell curve was Malthusian propaganda masquerading as science. That suited the ruling class just fine, and Murray was invited to address the House of Representatives. Another book, Inequality by Design, demolished every argument in the bell curve. However, its authors were not invited to address Congress. Politicians embraced the bell curve because it suited their slash-and-burn approach to social programs. The extent of inequality is determined by the balance of class forces, not by biology. The rebellions of the 1960s raised the standard of living so that by 1969, income inequality fell to a post-war low. In the 1970s, the employers' offensive drove down the standard of living of working people and caused inequality to rise again. Today, the gap between the super-rich and everyone else is greater than ever. People don't accept being robbed easily. The ruling class needs some way to keep the growing numbers of poor and angry people under control. The injustice system. The prisoner is the visible symbol of crime contained, the criminal caged and restrained, to give the unwitting citizen the feeling that the cops and jails are preserving his safety. William Ryan. Everyone wants justice and everyone wants to feel safe. Unfortunately, human needs are irrelevant to the, quote, justice system. Defense attorney Clarence Darrow explains, quote, "A jail is evidence of the lack of charity of the people on the outside who make the jails and fill them with the victims of their greed. Those men who own the earth make the laws to protect what they have. They fix up a sort of fence or pen around what they have, and they fix the law so the fellow on the other side cannot get in. The laws are really organized for the men who rule the world. They were never organized or enforced to do justice. We have no system for justice, not the slightest in the world." Close quote. The, quote, justice system exists to legalize the crimes of capitalism, class inequality, and deprivation. It is perfectly legal for the capitalist class to commit theft by taking what workers produce, to assault workers to raise productivity, and to commit murder through wars of acquisition. Crime is defined in ways that target the working class. If you take something from your workplace, that is considered stealing. If the power company raises its rates every month, that is considered business. In 2006, Las Vegas declared it a crime to feed homeless people in public parks. Failing to provide housing for the homeless, jobs for the jobless, medicine for the sick, and food for the hungry are not considered crimes. Governments and corporations can legally withhold life's essentials from those who cannot pay. Parents who treated their children this way would be thrown in jail. In The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Prison, Jeffrey Ryman calculates that corporate crime costs ordinary people far more money and causes many more deaths than common street crimes. Executives market dangerous and defective products like the Ford Pinto. Manufacturers dump toxic chemicals into the environment. Managers destroy jobs to raise profits. And drug company barons price medicines out of reach. Unlike many murderers sitting in prison for life, these gentlemen bandits, these intelligent, educated men and women who slowly and methodically plan the crimes that wreck the future of untold numbers of people, know exactly what they are doing and who will be hurt. Their crimes of cold, selfish greed reflect in their own way even more indifference to life than murder. Close quote. Darrow defined a criminal as a person with predatory instincts who has not sufficient capital to form a corporation. Those who do form corporations can ignore the law. General Electric has been convicted of 282 counts of contract fraud, and not a single GE executive sits in jail. A common criminal with 282 convictions would be incarcerated for life. Under California's three strikes law, Gary Ewing was sentenced to 25 years in prison for stealing three golf clubs, and Leandro Andrade was sentenced to 50 years in prison for stealing nine children's videotapes. The definition of violence also serves the system. If you kill someone, it's called murder. If the state kills someone, it's called justice. Politicians who demand that we get tough on crime never talk about cracking down on the causes of crime because the class system is the cause of crime. The poorest neighborhoods have similar high murder rates, whether they are predominantly black, white, or Hispanic. Drug addiction, prostitution, theft, assault, and murder are the result of no jobs, no money, no future, and no hope. A 2004 national survey of American cities revealed a direct relationship between deprivation, unemployment, less education, and lower income, and serious crime, including murder, rape, and robbery. The safest city was Newton, Massachusetts, and the most dangerous city was Camden, Pennsylvania. Newton's employment rate was more than five times higher than Camden's. More than two-thirds of Newton residents had a university degree, compared with only 5% of Camden residents. And the median household income in Newton was more than three times that of Camden's. The real crime in Camden is deprivation. If Camden residents had the same living standards as Newton residents, they would enjoy the same low crime rates. The violence that capitalism perpetrates is perfectly legal. In contrast, rebellion against injustice is not tolerated. As a result, prisons are filled with the victims of the greedy people who run society. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The world's biggest jailer. The fuse of America's prison explosion was lit in the late 1960s. With a war raging in Vietnam, riots sweeping major cities, and protests roiling college campuses, Congress responded with a major anti-crime bill that doled out millions of dollars to local police and increased the federal government's involvement in local law enforcement. Crime had never been much of an issue in federal politics before, but Richard Nixon made it a central campaign theme that year. In 1971, President Nixon announced that the nation's greatest problem was illegal drug use, not the poverty and desperation that caused people to use drugs. The subsequent war on drugs was a war on the poor in disguise. Previous administrations had sterilized the poor and left them to die from preventable diseases. The Nixon administration launched a campaign to imprison them in record numbers. In 1973, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller dramatically raised the penalties for drug offenses so that anyone caught selling 1 ounce of narcotics or possessing 2 ounces would get an automatic minimum sentence of 15 years in prison. Elaine Bartlett, a 26-year-old mother of four young children, was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison for her first offense, selling 4 ounces of cocaine. To those who moralize that Brown shouldn't have sold drugs, reggae artist Bounty Killer replies, "We do what we do so we stay alive. We sell what we sell because we want to survive." Mass incarceration went hand in hand with the assault on the gangs of the 1960s. Troublemakers could be locked up. The victims of heartless social policies could be painted as dangerous instead of deprived. A population that feared the criminal next door would be more willing to back the criminals in power. In 1976, the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty, and over the next 30 years, more than 1,000 people were executed by the state. All were poor, and almost all were people of color. Anti-drug laws and longer sentences filled America's prisons. Between 1970 and 2001, the national crime rate did not rise, yet the number of people in prison exploded from 200,000 to over 2 million, most of them nonviolent drug offenders. By 2001, the Rockefeller drug laws had resulted in an additional 325,000 person years of incarceration in New York State alone. Those years of life lost to prison were equivalent to 9,848 deaths, or more than three times the losses suffered in the bombing of the World Trade Center. By 2004, one out of every 138 U.S. residents was in jail. About 5 million Americans are arrested every year, and one in every five Americans has a criminal record. The victims of the penal system are the most vulnerable members of the working class, as the Reverend Jesse Jackson explains, quote, 65% of all prisoners are high school dropouts, 70% are functionally illiterate, and 63% recidivate. We are often tempted to think of China as an oppressive country, but we incarcerate 500,000 more people in this country, despite the fact that we have less than one-fourth the population of China. We lock up our poor, our uneducated, our unruly, our unstable, our addicted, where other countries provide treatment, mental hospitals, and care. Close quote. Mass incarceration is socially harmful. Like the workhouses of the 19th century, modern prisons are giant incubators for disease, confining sick people in crowded quarters with poor food and little or no medical care. Imprisoned addicts are denied clean drugs and clean needles, and all prisoners are denied condoms. As a result, the number of prisoners with HIV is 10 times the rate in the general population. Hepatitis C, an often lethal liver disease spread by blood exchange, infects an estimated 41% of inmates in California prisons, compared to less than 2% of the population at large. The law enforcement approach to drug use is directly responsible for the soaring rates of HIV/AIDS in America. Every year, hundreds of thousands of released prisoners take their diseases out of prison with them, endangering family, friends, and coworkers. In the early 1990s, a deadly strain of tuberculosis swept through the New York prison system, killing 35 prisoners and infecting more than 1,000 people outside. The employer's offensive has transformed the 1960s dream of liberation into a nightmare of persecution, incarceration, and disease. With only 5% of the world's population, the United States holds more than 25% of the world's prisoners. The Twin Towers Correctional Facility in Los Angeles is the biggest jail on the planet. The ruling class undoubtedly feels safer. However, the prison system does not prevent violence. It strengthens the greatest source of violence, the system itself. Martin Luther King Jr. acknowledged this when he said, I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. Blaming blacks. Inequality in America is not just a matter of class. Whole sections of the population are treated like second-class citizens solely because of their skin color. The ruling class needs to explain the oppression of black people in a way that does not implicate the system. The solution is blame the victim, racism. In 1965, a U.S. government report titled The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, blamed the depressed condition of blacks on their weak family structure. The report claimed that unless this damage is repaired, all the effort to end discrimination and poverty and injustice will come to little. Instead of pointing out that weak family structure is a result of racism and poverty, influential publications like Life, Look, and the New York Times supported the attack on anti-poverty programs. William Ryan wrote Blaming the Victim, to protest the resurgence of ideas about hereditary defects in blacks, the poor, and working people in general. In 1967, a trio of Harvard professors claimed that the urban rebellions that were rocking American cities could not be attributed to poor social conditions because most people who shared those conditions did not participate in the uprisings. Therefore, there must be something peculiar about those who rebelled, and that peculiarity should be studied. They showed no interest in why more people did not rebel against injustice. Under capitalism, submission is not considered to be a social problem. The Department of Justice rushed to fund the professor's quest to identify a violence gene and chemical imbalances that could be corrected by psychiatric drugs and brain surgery. One prisoner was recommended for psychosurgery because he was disrespectful, led a work strike, read revolutionary material, and refused to stop teaching karate and judo to his fellow inmates. In 1972, the National Institute for Mental Health decided to study the biological roots of violence in black youth. A national opposition movement closed down this project 2 years later. However, a number of states launched their own programs. California planned several centers for the study of the reduction of violence that would conduct genetic research and do brain surgery. Activists made sure they never opened. As Peter and Ginger Bregan point out, the arguments used to be that blacks were docile and hence biologically predisposed to slavery. Now in a few generations, they're supposed to be genetically predisposed to rebellion. This is not science. This is the use of psychiatry and science in the interest of social policy. Close quote. Washington was not deterred. In 1993, the National Research Council recommended mass psychiatric screening of black children as young as 4 months old to identify those who might be violence prone so they could be treated with medications that reduce violent behavior. The insistence that black equals criminal has long been used to persecute and incarcerate black people. White people form 70% of the U.S. population and commit the majority of interpersonal crimes, so that the typical American criminal is white. However, only 35% of the prison population is white. Black and Hispanic people fill the nation's prisons, not because skin color is genetically linked with criminality, but because the penal system has a history of targeting people of color, from the black codes of the early 1800s through Jim Crow segregation to the war on drugs. Continuing efforts to paint all blacks as criminals have reversed the gains of the civil rights movement and driven a wedge of fear between black and white populations. Modern racial profiling is a form of blaming the victim that goes something like this. Most people in prison are black. Therefore, blacks are more likely to be criminals. Therefore, the penal system is justified in targeting black people. Racial profiling has made it a crime to drive while black. Every day, thousands of black drivers are pulled over by police, searched, and abused simply because of their skin color. According to the Justice Department, police are more than twice as likely to search vehicles driven by blacks, even though whites are more than twice as likely to be found with illegal items. A report for the New Jersey State Police found that, quote, African Americans and Latinos account for 78% of those searched, yet troops found evidence of drugs in the searches of whites 25% of the time, of blacks 13% of the time, and of Latinos only 5% of the time, close quote. A 1998 national survey found that affluent, educated whites are more likely to be drug users and drug addicts. Nevertheless, police looking for illegal drug activity target blacks and black neighborhoods. Blacks are more likely than whites to be arrested, convicted, and sent to prison. Anti-drug laws victimize the poor, who are also more likely to be black. Probation is the only penalty for possessing 5 grams of expensive powdered cocaine. In contrast, possessing 5 grams of cheaper crack cocaine carries a mandatory 5-year prison sentence. Because of such systemic racism, 90% of the people in prison for drug possession are black. In 1980, there were 3 times as many black men in college as there were in prison. By 2000, there were nearly 200,000 more black men in prison than there were in college. On any given day, nearly 1 in 3 young black men in America is in prison, on probation, or on parole. In some places, like Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., more than half of the black male population is under the thumb of the judicial system. More victim blaming. The demand for greater productivity leads to more workplace accidents, injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. Instead of taking responsibility for these problems, employers blame workers for being careless and accident prone. In 1966, the term accident-prone personality was listed as a psychiatric diagnosis in the American Handbook of Psychiatry. Blaming the worker is more cost-effective than providing a safe workplace. Consider the following example. 33-year-old lineman Brent Churchill died when he reached for a 7,200-volt cable with his bare hands. His boss blamed Churchill's death on his failure to put on insulating gloves. The story behind the story was that the company had downsized the lineman department and was caught shorthanded during a major storm. Instead of calling back the laid-off workers, management forced the existing crews to work overtime. For 55 of the 60 hours before he died, Churchill was climbing up and down 30-foot poles in freezing weather. He was neither careless nor lazy. He was overworked and exhausted. Human beings are not machines. It is normal for people to become absent-minded and distracted by stress, fatigue, family problems, and other worries. At times, everyone misunderstands, misinterprets, and misreads. A workplace that functions safely only when no one ever makes a mistake is a dangerous workplace. A safe workplace protects workers when they make inevitable human errors. Medicine under capitalism has a strong element of victim blaming. The assumption that people who become sick must have done something wrong or be defective in some way. The protest movements of the 1960s challenged this view, emphasizing social conditions as a cause of poor health and demanding a national health care system. To counter this movement, the Rockefeller Foundation sponsored a conference in 1975 to set a new direction for health policy that would cut medical costs, crush the expectation that medical care should be a right, and divert attention from the social causes of disease. All 3 goals could be accomplished by blaming the victim. Speakers at the conference condemned, quote, irresponsible individuals who indulge in sickness-promoting behaviors and burden responsible people with excess taxes and higher medical insurance premiums. Following this conference, the Rockefeller Group wrote a series of policy papers promoting individual responsibility for health. In 1979, Healthy People, the Surgeon General's Report on Health Promotion and Disease Prevention, blamed personal excesses for the lion's share of runaway health costs. Subsequent government health promotion campaigns instructed the public to eat right, get active, stop smoking, drink responsibly, say no to drugs, abstain from sex, work safely, etc. The nation's medical journals fell in line with the new policy. The nation's medical journals fell in line with the new policy, treating health as an individual responsibility and sickness as a personal failure. One journal article blamed the lead poisoning of poor children on the permissive socialization of oral behavior. Instead of demanding that landlords remove lead-based paint from low-income apartments, parents were held responsible for letting children put their hands in their mouths after touching objects coated with lead dust. Blame the victim articles increased as more research funding was dedicated to study how poor people make themselves sick. The campaign to blame the sick found an ally in the self-help movements of the 1970s. people practicing holistic health care rejected the use of medicines and vaccines. Self-care was promoted as the way to free oneself from reliance on doctors and potentially harmful medical treatments. The New Age emphasis on personal responsibility meshed with the employer's efforts to dismantle state-funded medical care, while social activists fought for more access to the medical system. Self-help advocates like Ivan Illich argued that less access would be more beneficial. When it comes to epidemics like cancer, victim blaming is rampant. While industries flood the environment with cancer-causing chemicals and the state dismantles environmental protections, cancer research concentrates on modifying individual behaviors, drinking, smoking, nutrition, and developing individual treatments. Cancer prevention is dismissed as unrealistic. According to the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, quote, "Breast cancer cannot be prevented. However, studies show that early detection of breast cancer saves lives." Close quote. Preventing cancer would require removing carcinogens from production, cleaning up toxic waste dumps, closing down the nuclear power industry, and prohibiting the military from using chemical and radioactive weapons. In other words, cancer prevention is impossible under capitalism. With cancer prevention blocked at the social level, experts concentrate on advising individuals what they should and should not do to prevent cancer. Their recommendations are as useful as duck and cover exercises during the Cold War, where school children were instructed to duck under their desks and cover their heads in case of a nuclear attack. Personal protective measures don't prevent cancer. They blame people for getting cancer by focusing on individual behavior. Even personality can be targeted. Some experts warn that the risk of cancer increases for people who repress their emotions and ignore their needs. Ironically, the same behaviors that employers demand of workers, especially women. In fact, the cancer-prone personality is a myth. Scientific studies on two continents found absolutely no connection between personality type and susceptibility to cancer. Nevertheless, the myth endures because it offers false hope to people who want to avoid cancer, makes money for those who sell hope, and takes pressure off the primary source of cancer, the capitalist system. It would be wonderful if people could be healthy simply by making the right choices. However, most illnesses arise from social conditions, overwork, unemployment, workplace hazards, excess stress, inadequate housing, poverty and malnutrition, environmental toxins, and lack of medical care. As long as people live in health-damaging conditions, it is impossible to distinguish how much the individual contributes and how much society contributes to any particular problem. Do individuals have any responsibility for their health? People should be held responsible only for what they control. They cannot be held responsible for what they do not control. Capitalism turns this principle upside down. Those with the most power take no responsibility for social problems. Those with the least power get all the blame. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, Henry Ford blamed lazy workers for high unemployment. "The average man won't really do a day's work unless he is caught and cannot get out of it. There's plenty of work to do if people would do it," close quote. A week later, he laid off 75,000 auto workers. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. An Unjust World. The pyramid-shaped socioeconomic hierarchy and the power of the elite at the top of it will be secure as long as those at the lower levels blame one another for their lack of access to jobs with greater decision-making power, and as long as they fail to question the system that makes the decision-making power scarce in the first place by holding so much of it at the top. Jeff Schmidt. We want to think we live in a just world where people reap what they sow, where what goes around comes around, and where those who play by the rules are rewarded. Belief in a just world is shaken by tragedy and secured by blaming the victim. When Andrea Yates killed her children in a psychotic state, I overheard someone say, She shouldn't have had so many children if she couldn't take care of them. Such blaming comments shield people from thinking about the desperate conditions that could drive a mother, possibly any mother, to kill her children. It is more comforting to condemn Yates than to think about how trapped she was and how trapped we are. People blame themselves for the problems in their lives because, in a strange way, self-blame offers the illusion of control. I could have made something of myself if only I had... Blaming implies responsibility, that the person had the power to make things right and just messed up. People would rather blame themselves than think that forces beyond their control could pull the rug out from under them no matter what they do. If there is no justice in society, if people can be harmed through no fault of their own, then we are powerless to protect ourselves and our loved ones. Powerlessness is so frightening that people dissociate from reality and believe what they want to believe. It is more comforting to believe that misfortune visits only those who make bad decisions, so that one can be safe by making good decisions. In reality, the world is a dangerous place because the people in charge protect themselves at the expense of everyone else. The struggles of the 1960s exposed capitalism as a sick system, and masses of people began to see that they were in the same boat. To take back control, the ruling class had to change that perception. Hollywood did its part, producing films like Easy Rider and Up in Smoke that portrayed the 1960s as a continuous orgy of drugs, sex, and rock and roll. If you remember the 1960s, then you weren't there. The fact that millions of people had organized to change the world was belittled and then erased from public memory. When the social matrix in which we are embedded is invisible, it is easier to blame individuals for social problems and for individuals to blame themselves and each other. Ordinary people do not benefit from victim blaming. By 2001, the annual cost of police, courts, and prisons had reached $267 billion, up from $36 billion in 1982. This money was taken from social programs known to reduce crime, education, job training, recreational programs, better housing, and treatment for mental illness and drug addiction. Persecuting poor people doesn't make society safer. It results in more desperation and less public safety. Criminalizing drug use leads to more drug use and more drug-related crimes. Illegal drugs are so expensive that poor addicts must sell them to pay for their own supply. Others resort to theft and prostitution. One study of a crackdown on illegal drug use found that as police cleared one area, drug-related activity moved into new areas. A 1994 study funded by the White House recommended that funds be transferred from law enforcement to drug treatment programs because treatment is 7 times more cost-effective than domestic drug enforcement in reducing cocaine use and 15 times more cost-effective in reducing the social costs of crime and lost productivity, close quote. The Clinton administration rejected this advice because the war on drugs is not about stopping drug use. Its purpose is to impose social control. That same year, President Clinton ended educational grants for prisoners, even though education is the single most important factor in whether a released prisoner returns to jail. Prisons are big business. The public foots the bill, and private corporations reap the profits, not only from government contracts, but also from convict labor. In 1979, Congress created the Prison Industry Enhancement Certification Program that allows businesses to employ inmates and sell prisoner-made goods. The prison labor system is modern legal slavery. Prisoners are compliant, disposable labor with no legal rights. Inmate workers earn just pennies an hour, so the profits are huge, billions of dollars every year. More prisoners and longer sentences mean even more profit. At the beginning of the 21st century, class inequality has never been greater. The race to incarcerate reflects the determination of the capitalist class to continue squeezing the working class and to prevent them from rebelling against this injustice. Criminalizing drug use allows the state to intervene in the daily activities of the working class. More cops, more prisons, and harsher laws give the ruling class more power to dominate society. Blaming the most exploited and oppressed for social problems is like blaming the canaries in the mine who keeled over when toxic gas levels rise. The canaries warn the miners that their lives are in danger. The poor and the persecuted are like society's canaries. Their suffering warns everyone else that they are next. We can shoot the messenger by blaming the victim, or we can heed the message. Portraying victims as villains only works when the majority is divided. The next chapter explains how the capitalist class divides in order to rule. Summary: feudalism attributed class inequality to God's will. Capitalism attributes class inequality to the superiority of the few and the defectiveness of the many. Blaming the victim protects the system. As long as ordinary people blame themselves and each other for the problems that are created by the ruling class, there will be more problems and more victims. And I've been reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, that the conclusion of Chapter 10, Blaming the Victim.